From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd, and for Jeremy Hobson, this is Here and Now. The Environmental Protection Agency is going toe-to-toe with California over pollution standards that will have major implications for the automotive industry and climate change policy. EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt said yesterday the agency will roll back Obama-era fuel efficiency standards that require cars and trucks to get 55 miles per gallon by 2025. Pruitt spoke this morning in Washington.
As you know, I'm here to announce that those standards that were set that we are obligated to evaluate, we are determining, I am determining, that those standards are inappropriate and should be revised.
A group of automakers lobbied last year for changes, saying the standards were too difficult to meet. But California now appears ready for a legal battle to preserve the right to set its own rules. Joining us now is Craig Miller. He's science editor at KQED in San Francisco. Hi, Craig.
Hey, Peter.
So Scott Pruitt says he wants to roll back these fuel efficiency standards across the country, but he's also going after a waiver that has allowed California to set its own rules since like the 1970s. And that's a key in your state, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a linchpin in the state's pretty aggressive plans to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And it is where the real fight is going to be. There are two things going on here. There are the fuel efficiency standards themselves, and then this waiver, this special permission that's granted under the Clean Air Act for California to basically set its own rules and for other states to be able to pick those rules up, including the one you're broadcasting from, Massachusetts. There are about 12 other states that have signed on to California's standard. And all of those states combined represent about a third, I've heard, as much as 40% of the auto market. So it's pretty seismic what's happening here.
It is going to affect up to 130 million people, I believe, live in within those 12 states, too. So, I mean, what kind of statement is it making nationally on what the Trump administration is trying to do, broadly speaking, when it comes to climate change policy?
It's making a kind of a confusing statement, actually, because one of the things that the Trump administration has been saying, sort of a mantra of theirs, and particularly organizations like the EPA under Scott Pruitt, is that they want business to have regulatory clarity and consistency. Well, we have that right now. We have a national standard that's pretty aggressive, this 55 by 25 that you mentioned. This goes back to you remember about a decade ago when the ailing auto industry was bailed out by the Obama administration. And part of the deal was, okay, guys, we'll bail you out, but in exchange, you have to start ratcheting up fuel economy according to a pretty aggressive schedule. And everybody signed on to that. And that was done in consultation with California, which already had stricter rules under this waiver. So now there's this one national standard that all the automakers have been trying to hit, targets spaced out over several years. And now the EPA is saying we want to tear that up, basically, and possibly result in a fragmented market where there are two different standards that automakers have to try to figure out how to make vehicles under this one, how to make vehicles under that one, where to sell this car, where to sell that car. So it's kind of hard to see where the regulatory clarity and consistency is under that.
Now, the chief executive of Ford wrote a blog post last week that said, while he would like more flexibility on meeting that Obama-era rule, he does support increasing clean car standards through 2025, and they are not asking for a rollback. So as you point out, this is very confusing probably for the automotive industry and very important to them. They need to get this figured out.
Yeah, the industry is kind of split on this, and it's difficult for them because they need about 3 years lead time to design for any given model year. And right now, we don't know what we're going to be looking at 3 years from now. The state of California has not explicitly said that it's going to court over this, but I think it's almost a foregone conclusion that they will, and that it'll become a protracted court battle, which could tie things up for another year or two, I'm hearing, in which case the automakers are sitting around wondering what standard they should be designing for.
Hmm. So what do you think the next steps would be? You mentioned a possible lawsuit. I know your governor and your state attorney general both very fired up about this. In fact, they're fired up about the Trump administration on many topics.
Oh, yeah. This is just the latest in a long line of lawsuits and legal battles, scraps with the Trump administration. I think there are, at this point, at least 50 lawsuits going back and forth over a whole range of things, many of them environmental. Governor Brown has called this move by the EPA a cynical abuse of power. And the head of the Air Board here, Mary Nichols, has said, as far as she's concerned, it changes nothing here. California and the 12 other states with the same rules are going to stay the course, so to speak, as long as the law allows them to do so.
That's Craig Miller. He's science editor at KQED, and he's joined us from San Francisco. Craig, thanks for your time.
You bet, Peter.
Well, in France, they're calling today Black Tuesday. A major strike brought that country's high-speed trains to a halt, passengers scrambling. It's the first day in a wave of scheduled strikes to protest President Macron's labor reforms. He's already taken broad steps to make it easier for bosses to hire and fire workers. And now he wants to phase out the contracts, which basically give rail workers a job for life, annual pay raises, and a generous early retirement policy. The union says he's paving the way for privatization. The BBC's Hugh Schofield joins us from Paris. Hugh, give us context. Who's on strike again? Why?
There are various groups on strike today, including, rubbish men and various students and energy workers, Air France, pilots. But, they're really not the focus here. The focus really is on the railway unions. And the railway unions have called this start of a long series of strikes, which are going to go on, according to their schedule, up till the end of June. Two days of strike, 3 days off, 2 days of strike, 3 days off, right through for, weeks and weeks and weeks ahead. Today's the first day, and it has hit hard. As you were saying, when only 1 in 10 or so of the big fast TGV trains are running, that means it's a really big strike. 80% or something of drivers have stopped work. So this is the big test. One senses that of the Macron government.
Well, is this all support for the unions and the reform he was trying to do? Remind us what he did.
You've got to remember that Macron's government is, in general, a reforming government. In all sorts of spheres, it is changing things. Not necessarily particularly dramatically. It's not Thatcherite necessarily or Reaganite. It's not overturning the French way of life, but it is gradually and systematically going through different aspects of French life and modernizing it. And it can't do that job without taking on the SNCF, that's the railway company, which is, in many people's views, a very important part of French life, but one that really does need reform. And that's certainly the government's view. Today's action is specifically about what Macron wants to do to the rail company, though, of course, the broader context is that the rail unions see themselves as the vanguard of the sort of Praetorian Guard protecting the socialistic system, the big welfare state, the big public sector, which France has had for the last, 75 years. And so, in a way, this is also a strike about the conception of what kind of France is going to emerge at the end of the Macron presidency.
And by the way, just tick off some of the things he wants to do. Or did.
On the railway front, what he wants to do is make it ready for the competition in the rail system in Europe, which is coming, because the European Union has made those rules. And whether or not the railway workers want it, or anyone wants it, it's coming. There will be German-Italian competition on the French railways very soon, in a couple of years. The government's view is that to take part in that competition, and in order to succeed in that competition, in order to be able to compete in Italy and Germany and get new markets and so on, the SNCF needs to be a more modern company, run on more modern ways. And in many ways, it's not run in modern ways. For example, and this is one thing they're going to change, they want to change the government, there's such a thing as the statute for SNCF workers, 150,000 of them, which gives them a kind of pay grade system and a system of promotion which is utterly rigid, utterly automatic, and which the government says is just no way to run human resources in a modern company. That kind of thing they want to change, but of course that's a red rag to the unions, who see it as part of their inherited social rights.
Well, and how is President Macron handling this so far? Is there a way to tell even today on this day? Has he come out? Has he said anything?
Not yet. He won't. It is too early to read very much into how it's going to be conducted. We certainly know that, the government intends to push ahead. There's no indication that it wants to give way on the main points of our reform plan, because that is what we came to power to do, and now we're doing it. The key point in all of this is going to be public opinion. Public opinion at the moment, I think, is broadly in favour of the Macron government, quite likes what's happened so far. They've managed to introduce quite a lot of reforms and sort of ended the notion that France is unreformable, and all that's great. But, you know, if these strikes in the rail system go on and cause more chaos and people really find their nerves being tested by it all, then it'll get tense. People might at some point start blaming the government and start saying, well, hang on a sec, they're being so obstinate in the government, why can't they just come to terms with the unions, who after all are just defending the public sector? And at that point, the mood in France is very fickle when it comes to these public sector issues. And the government needs to tread very, very carefully in the coming weeks.
The BBC's Hugh Schofield in Paris. And a reminder, too, that those maybe heading to France for maybe a little springtime in Paris might want to look at the strike schedule as they make their plans. Hugh, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
It was a place where Mary Jo Kopechne, by all accounts a young woman with a great future, died horribly. It was a scandal that derailed the presidential hopes of Senator Edward Kennedy and launched a million conspiracy theories. It was an impossibly pure symbol of innocent summer getaways until the accident.
I don't really like talking about the accident and all of that time. It was like a change of our lives, this whole thing. Totally changed our island.
A resident of Chappaquiddick, the island a stone's throw off the island of Martha's Vineyard off Massachusetts, Chappaquiddick is now also a film. In 1969, Senator Ted Kennedy was on the island to host a reunion of the men and women who worked for his brother Robert Kennedy, whose assassination was still a raw wound. Australian Jason Clark stars as Kennedy. Here he toasts Mary Jo Kopechne and the other young women who crunched data in a small locked room during campaigns.
We named you girls the Boiler Room Girls. I like to think we called you that because working on Bobby's campaign, you had such a fire in your bellies, wanting to live up to the name on that ticket, wanting to prove yourselves worthy of it. Kennedy name.
Then Kennedy and Kopechne left the gathering. His car went off a small wooden bridge on Chappaquiddick. He got out. She didn't. Kennedy didn't report the accident for 10 hours, eventually pled guilty to leaving the scene. His family had lost three sons, and now the fourth had caused the death of someone else's child. He tried to gain sympathy with a phony neck brace, but eventually, the film suggests, forged the social justice career that's also a part of his legacy. Jason Clark joins us now from the NPR West Studios in Culver City. Jason, welcome.
Hello.
And there we are, hearing that you are Australian. John Curran is with you as well. He directed Chappaquiddick. John, welcome to you as well.
Hi, Robin. Thanks for having us.
Jason, this is a figure who looms large. Wow, and you're Australian. What was your thinking about? I've got to get this right.
Yeah, bringing a very intimate portrait of a man, you know, in a very dark week of his soul.
Hmm. Were you as profoundly aware of this story as many Americans are?
Yes, I was. I knew of Chappaquiddick. I knew of the Kennedys. I met Ted Kennedy on a boat off Hyannisport when I was shooting Brotherhood. I had no idea of the details of this event, such as the 10 hours, such as she wore a neck brace to the funeral. And the more I went down this rabbit hole of the Kennedys, the more I just could not bring myself out of the attraction of this story.
What was your sense of him when you met him?
He was Ted Kennedy. He was a man who, you know, I agree with his politics, education, healthcare, civil rights. You know, he was a titan of America in the 20th century. He was impressive.
But how would you say you portrayed him? We see him as a pitiful man-child looking to everyone around him to fix his problem. His father wants him to come up with an alibi. He doesn't. He does eventually take responsibility. But even when he does, surrounded by, you know, former president's men like Ted Sorensen, it feels political. He suggests that he go on primetime TV and make a statement. In this scene, we're going to hear from some of the Kennedy advisors first, then your character, Ted Kennedy, stands up.
It's actually not a bad idea. The networks will donate the time if it's part of their news coverage.
We could frame the national conversation the way we want it framed. And how do we do that?
He's got to look sympathetic.
It'd be easier to get him to fill in for Carson.
We tell the truth, or at least our version of it. And it ends with an appeal to the voters, to the people that elected me. We need to remind them that this family perseveres, that we don't back down from a fight, that we don't get backed into a corner. We have a true compass and we follow it. Now, I followed mine the best I could that night. And me and Paul and Joe, we did everything we could to save that poor girl.
You got a winner there, son.
Amen to that.
We tell them the truth, or at least our version of it. Jason Clark, how were you approaching Ted Kennedy at that moment?
As a real person, a human being, you know, he's, you know, a 34-year-old, 35-year-old man who was fathering 14 children, 12 of Bobby's, 2 of Jack's, and 1 of his own, who was possibly depressed, maybe clinically depressed, who was a year on from the murder of his, this is the second brother he'd had murdered. It was very important to make that person real, to give the audience an intimate look at this man who we see from such a distance, and to take you down and with him on his, you know, his journey of his moral soul.
John Curran, Taylor Allen, and Andrew Logan wrote the script, and you had to pick which story you were going to tell. Kennedy first said he swam off the island. You show him rowing a boat. There were conflicting stories on whether his friends dove to try to get her out.
Well, those are the facts. I mean, we always tried to stay as close to the facts as possible from the inquest, from anecdotal evidence, etc. But, you know, there's things that we don't know, and only 2 people know, and they're right, of course, both dead. And it isn't like I'm blowing the lid off the truth of Chappaquiddick because nobody knows, you know. But I think the bigger point of the film is the reaction to this accident.
Well, but people see films as the definitive history. Did that worry you at all? I mean, the same in asking Jason about portraying this man who's been both lionized and, criticized.
I don't think there's really that much of a mystery. I think it's, you know, a guy and a young woman go out. They've been drinking. There's a witness who happened to be a cop who saw them in the car. And that's probably a very good reason why they took off at such a high speed. The bridge is less than a mile from that intersection. So it's pretty obvious what happened. What happened afterwards, I think, you know, Jason and I have been out on that bridge late at night, and there's no ambient light. It's pitch black,
yeah,
and there's a strong current. I mean, it's very conceivable that what happened is what Ted says happened. He tried to rescue her and he couldn't.
I have to say, every time I go over the bridge at Chappaquiddick, there are no sides to it. It goes at an angle off the road, and you wonder why more people haven't gone off it. Jason, what was that like to be in that place that is so beautiful, where something so horrible happened?
It's haunting. It's also that the place is the edge of America. And I always had this feeling as Ted when we sat there and we just examined it, of like the minute Ted turned his face, you know, from the Atlantic Ocean towards, you know, the house, towards Washington, towards his responsibility and his justification, that, you know, it would have been a very lonely, cold decision.
John Curran, you talked about how you took most of this from a record. People question the record because there was an Edgartown, Massachusetts court inquest. But as we see in your film, there's a close relationship between officials and the Kennedy men. In this scene, former U.S. Attorney Paul Markham, played by Jim Gaffigan, calls the police chief who's having a press conference.
Hello.
Chief, thank God I got you.
I need to ask a big favor. Can you hold off on the senator's statement just a little longer?
You're going to have to speak up, son. I've got a room full of reporters here.
I need you to hold off on releasing the senator's statement a little longer.
Well, I'm sorry. I've already released it.
What?
And you also had to imagine scenes. Here you have Ted Kennedy talking to Mary Jo Kopechne, played by Kate Mara, and he asked her what she would have done if it had been her brother who died.
I'd quit, leave Washington, never look back, which is exactly what I did. But I'm not you. He wasn't my brother.
Yeah, well, I had 3 generations of advisors up my ass trying to convince me to run. None of them listened to me. I mean, everyone tried to convince me otherwise. Everyone except Joey said the country needed me. I just needed my name.
I felt it was very important to get to the heart of who Mary Jo was. Mm. It's only a year after Bobby was killed. And by all accounts, Teddy was very depressed, and so was she. She left Washington. She couldn't deal with it.
You also foreshadow at the end of the film what Ted Kennedy was to become.
Yeah, I mean, I'm like Jason. I'm a fan of Ted, and there's no senator that achieved more by both parties for his entire career. He was rated, you know, number one for working across the aisle.
But I can hear the Kennedy faithful saying, well, then why make this movie? You know, he can't fight back. He can't, you know, he's not here.
Ted's legacy is Ted's legacy, good and bad, and there's nothing wrong with looking at it honestly. I find it odd that that question comes up. Why wouldn't we look at this story? I find it unbelievable that this film has not been made. What a gripping story. I mean, how does journalism feel about how it was reported back on the day? This story brings up a lot of issues about the people we hold in high regard and we revere. Ted's legislative and his politics stands as is. His question as what kind of human being he was, whether he should have faced charges and all that, is worth debating.
There are Kennedy haters who always feel that he was a murderer who got away with murder. And you don't.
I wouldn't say murderer.
They do. And they might say you don't go far enough.
We've been accused of that. There's a lot of dislike for Kennedy on Martha's Vineyard as well. And we just screened the film there. That community, we had one gentleman that got up and said, we thank you very much. We've had this, carried this with us for 30 or 40 years. We all knew what happened that day. And murder, whatever. I mean, negligent homicide is the worst he would have been charged with. But, you know, the fact that people do not know what exists, I find just shocking. Even as an Australian, I love this country. I love everything it's done and given me. But, you know, the fact that people sit here and ask why now, you know, Ted's legacy is there. The good that he has done exists.
That's Jason Clark, the Australian actor who plays Ted Kennedy in the new film directed by John Curran, Chappaquiddick, a name that has such power. John, Jason, thank you both so much.
Thank you very
much, Robin.
Mining is a boom and bust business. Case in point, the tin market, which collapsed back in 1985 but has enjoyed a rebound over the years. NPR's Frank Langfitt reports on how demand for consumer electronics may help revive the abandoned South Crofty tin mine in the English county of Cornwall.
Cornwall's a rugged peninsula that juts out into the Atlantic, and tin mining's been a part of life here for thousands of years. It even spawned popular novels, a couple of BBC series, about this fictional British soldier named Poldark. He returns from the American Revolutionary War to reopen his family's tin mine.
My friends, when my father closed this mine 20 years ago, he little thought it would have a future. Today, with your help, we aim to prove him wrong.
Now, life is imitating art as miners are trying to reopen an abandoned mine here that dates back to the 1600s. Paul Solomon's drilling blasting holes into the mine wall for explosives. And over the years, the tin bust here, it's forced him and other Cornish miners to find all kinds of other work.
I went commercial fishing, then ended up in building trade. I went logging.
Now, he's working for Strongbow Exploration, Vancouver-based company, which is trying to bring this old mine back to life. It's not going to be easy because, as you can hear, there's a ton of water down here. Oh, and Myelop is Strongbow's chief operating officer.
They closed the mine and they switched the pumps off. It took about 3 years for the mine to fill with water. In total, the mine contains around 8 to 10 million cubic meters of water.
How are you going to get it out?
We're going to get it out by putting submersible pumps into the main shaft and drawing the water out through a straw, essentially.
Myelop says they can pump 10 Olympic swimming pools worth of water out each day, but it's going to take up to 2 years. Why go to so much trouble for a mine that's far older than America? Myelop says it's all about demand, because demand for tin has nearly doubled in the past two decades.
We've seen a boom in the amount of electronic equipment that people have in their homes, and every single piece of electronics needs solder to glue the components to circuit boards.
That solder, as we Americans call it, used to be made with lead. Now, most of it is made with tin and goes into everything from iPhones to laptops. Traditional tin mining countries like Indonesia and China are producing less. And since early 2016, the price of tin has risen from $13,000 a ton to around $20,000. If South Crofty reopens, Owen Myelop says there'll be 300 new mining jobs in one of England's poorest regions. Across the street outside of a supermarket, people are skeptical.
I can't see it happening because, as I said, they've tried it so many times.
David Victor's 75 and he used to mine tin. He's seen past attempts to open South Crofty fail.
But I suppose it depends on the economics and the shortage of tin supply from other places.
Back underground in the flooded mine, Paul Solomon's pretty hopeful. He was part of a team that tried to reopen the mine years ago.
Things are looking better this time.
Why did it not work the first time, if I may ask?
I think it's all down to money.
Are you more optimistic this time around?
Yes, definitely. I want this to see me out now.
Solomon hopes to finish his working days here as men had for thousands of years, mining tin. But first, he's got to get South Crofty up and running again. Frank Langford, NPR News, Cornwall.
China's tariffs on U.S. goods target 128 U.S. products, including almonds, wine, and ginseng, which is facing a 15% tariff. Ginseng is the root used in herbal remedies and teas. It's very popular in Asia, and nearly all of the ginseng grown in the U.S. is shipped to China. And almost all of it is grown in Marathon County, Wisconsin, a county that went for President Trump in 2016. One of the ginseng farmers there is Jim Schumacher. He's co-owner of Schumacher Ginseng, a mid-sized family farm in Marathon. Jim, what did you think when you heard about that tariff, 15%?
Well, it's very concerning. I don't like to see tariffs in anything, and to have it hit a little industry like ours here in Wisconsin, it definitely is concerning.
Have you done some of the math? Because we've heard pork farmers, for instance, get out a napkin and do some math on the back, and it's $35,000 a year for one farmer I heard from. Have you done that yet?
Yeah, really, it depends on the size of the farmer. But, the industry here in Wisconsin probably shipped about, around $30 million worth of ginseng to China last year. So it ends up being a large amount for the farmers here in Wisconsin.
What about for you? Can you figure it out?
I can. I haven't penciled it out yet, but, it definitely amounts to a lot. And the problem is it's not just the 15% tariff. It's, will the price raise also for the consumers in China? Once you bring it in there, obviously the price is 15% higher, or we're going to take the 15%. So is it going to affect the amount of ginseng we sell also?
Yeah. Well, a couple things. Who knew? I did not know that the U.S. sent so much ginseng to China and also that it's preferable. In other words, we've been reading that the tins of ginseng that have an American flag on it are the bigger sellers in China. When did this change? Because we think of ginseng as coming from China.
This type of ginseng that we grow here in Wisconsin is the American or the Panax quinquefolia species. And it's, the cultivating industry started here in Wisconsin in the early 1900s. And for 75 years, Wisconsin grew 95% of this type of ginseng worldwide. Mm. And the trade began in the early 1900s with China. And the ginseng that we grow here in Wisconsin, like I said, is the American species, which is different than the Chinese or Korean grown ginseng. So if you look at the way it's used in traditional Chinese medicine, ours is considered more of a cooling type herb, whereas the Korean or Chinese grown ginseng is considered a stimulating or a hot type of ginseng.
Well, and we understand the industry has gone up and down before. The tobacco industry crashed and a lot of big tobacco farmers in Canada diversified. They started growing ginseng. The market has had its fluctuations.
That is correct. For about 75 years, almost all of that type of ginseng was grown here in Marathon County in Wisconsin. Until around the 1990s, that's when all of a sudden the market was flooded with a lot of ginseng coming out of Canada. For the Chinese customer, the Wisconsin-grown ginseng is still considered the premium quality ginseng. And if you look on the market, we definitely command a higher price.
Well, what a history. Who knew? And now looking at it, Daniel Boone made a fortune selling ginseng in China, of course, years ago. But here you are in Marathon County, Wisconsin. What's the talk there about what's going to happen? And what's the feeling about the fact that this is retaliation for President Trump's tariffs against China? He was warned that, he could get himself into a tariff war. What's the feeling there?
Yeah, obviously, we're not happy with it. I don't agree with any type of tariff placed on any products, but obviously when it comes back and hits our industry like that, yeah, obviously we're very concerned about it. You know, we don't want to see a decline in the crop here. You know, like you said, it had fluctuated over the years, and over the last 10 years, we kind of stabilized here, and the industry was going well, so you don't like to see something like this happen.
Well, no, but I have to ask, did you vote for Donald Trump?
Well, you know, let's just put it this way. I don't agree with the policies in terms of the tariffs and trade and
okay.
things like that.
Well, but if you have friends who did, he was very much anti-free trade. That was what he said on the campaign trail. Do you think people just didn't hear it? Or
maybe that, and maybe they didn't expect it to go this far. You know, a lot of the things said on the campaign trail were more threats and things like that, I would think, and you just don't expect it to, you know, materialize probably. So it just, you know, when it affects your industry, then it definitely, you know, you definitely feel it a lot more.
Yeah. Jim Schumacher, co-owner of Schumacher Ginseng, a farm in Marathon County, Wisconsin, which produces most of the ginseng that's exported to China and is going to be hit with a big tariff. Jim, best of luck to you.
Thank you very much.
Well, in Colorado, the Denver Nuggets take on the Indiana Pacers tonight as the regular season winds down, and the Nuggets are leaning on a 6'10" Serbian power forward superstar, Nikola Jokic, one of the NBA's top young players. He's going to try to help end their 4-year playoff drought, and he's got fans from Denver's small Serbian community to back home. Vic Vela from Colorado Public Radio reports.
Aside from the language spoken, St. John the Baptist Serbian Orthodox Church in the Denver suburb of Lakewood is pretty much like any other church. On Sundays, it's filled with hymns and prayer and worshipers in their Sunday best. The church started serving the Serbian community a couple of years ago. Father Radovan Petrovic moved to Denver from Serbia in 2006 to act as pastor.
There was a need because of the new wave of immigrants that came after the violent breakup of Yugoslavia, who settled in Denver, and then they decided they needed a church in this area. But Serbs have been present in Colorado since 19th century as one of the earliest miners in the area.
The Serbian community in Denver is small. Petrovic says there's only about 150 families living here, but they're tight-knit, and there's many things that bind them, like socializing after church and talking about Serbia's most popular sport, basketball. And these days, there's one name they're all going crazy for, the Joker.
Who's your favorite basketball player?
I think he's awesome because he has cool rebounds and he's really nice. The reason I love basketball is because he inspired me to play basketball.
That's 11-year-old Ogi Petrovic, who started playing basketball a few years ago, shortly after his favorite player joined the Nuggets. Jokic is only 23 years old, but he's already established himself as one of the most dynamic young players in the NBA. Someone who dishes dazzling assists and can shoot from long range.
So when I was watching him on TV, I saw him shoot a three-pointer and make it.
Jokic for three. Yes!
I was like, whoa, that's so cool. And then I started practicing and got really good at it, and that's what I'm really proud of.
Jokic sometimes attends St. John's Church, and for a guy who lives a long way from home, he's grateful for the love he receives from fans in Denver.
It's a really nice feeling, and you know that, especially because they're from Serbia, they speak in my language, it's kind of just like a good feeling to know that there is someone who is in the United States who is speaking your language and supporting you, so it's kind of cool stuff, you know.
And Jokic is not only the most popular player among Serbs in Denver, he's a really big deal back home, too. Agi Stojaković is a Nuggets assistant coach who's also from Serbia. He said there was once a time when the biggest star back home was tennis great Novak Djokovic, but the popularity rankings have changed. It used to be
Novak Djokovic, then God. Now it's Nikola, Novak Djokovic, and then God. So,
so God is in third place now.
Of course. He doesn't play any sport.
And Serbians back home value Jokic perhaps even more than they do sleep.
I get a lot of messages. We are getting up because in Serbia it's like 3 a.m. and they're waking up and they're watching my games. So it's kind of you kind of want to play good for them.
As one of the Nuggets' star players, Jokic earns about $1.5 million a year, so he could live in any big city he wants. But he chooses to go back to his small hometown in Serbia every offseason, where he can relax and fish and spend time with his horse. Dan Niegomir is a member of St. John's Church. He says that's one more thing that makes Jokic typically Serbian.
Ours is a very, very old culture that has strong, strong ties to the Balkans. And I'm sure that things tug at his heart and he misses this, that, and the other thing from home.
Assistant coach Agi Stojakovic says that's exactly the kind of thing that endears the Serbian community to Jokic, because in him they see themselves.
He's a national hero, so it's like people identify with him. So especially people like who lives here, so like, you know, they have probably the same or similar feelings that we have. So, you know, like their heart is probably still at home, and, you know, Nikola is, people identify themselves with him.
But while people back home in Serbia can't wait to see Jokic again this offseason, they and every Nuggets fan hope they'll have to wait a little longer than usual as Jokic tries to lead the team to the playoffs. For Here and Now, I'm Vic Vela in Denver.
The music streaming company Spotify goes public today in a unique kind of initial public offering. Instead of issuing new shares to big institutional investors, Spotify will let existing investors offer their shares directly to the public. The company is valued at around $20 billion ahead of today's IPO. It has 71 million subscribers, but it is still losing a lot of money. Let's go now to our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Teddy Schleifer is a senior editor at Recode. And Teddy, so this is not a typical IPO. What do we need to know about it?
Right. Basically, this is seen as sort of an inflection point in this push and pull between Silicon Valley, which has one very clear set of cultural norms, and Wall Street, which has another. As you mentioned, you know, this is a very different style IPO, or, you know, maybe you shouldn't even call it an IPO. But I think the bigger picture here is that this push and pull between Silicon Valley and Wall Street has had tensions at times, but basically both sides have needed each other. Silicon Valley needed bankers to help take their companies public. Bankers needed Silicon Valley to give them money. This is effectively a way for them to somewhat circumvent the banker system, the banking system that Silicon Valley has depended on. So even if you don't care about Spotify, even if the music industry isn't that interesting to you, this is ultimately going to be could very well recast the relationship between a lot of kind of starry-eyed tech folks and, you know, hard-charging, deal-cutting bankers.
I'm looking at the valuation of Spotify. Yeah. As we said, $20 billion. How is that possible? Last year, the company lost $461 million.
Sure. Well, it's possible, I guess, because like everything in Silicon Valley, you know, some investor said that's what it was worth. You know, Spotify is going to looks like, you know, as of right now, shares are going to start listing at about $165 per share. But, you know, the bigger question here is, you know, Spotify has been able to have, you know, the $20 billion valuation is partially driven by this massive paid subscription business they've built, which is enviable in a lot of, you know, corners of whether it's e-commerce or social media. I mean, there are 71 million paid subscribers to the system. And that's something that's commendable, and that's ultimately what they're marketing to probably to investors as well, that they have a direct billing relationship with that many people is pretty impressive.
But the thing about the way Spotify makes money is that every 75 cents that – for every dollar that they make, 75 cents is going into royalties for the record label. So anyone who's willing to invest – in Spotify has got to believe that eventually the company is going to either change that or find a way that it can eventually start making money, a profit.
You're absolutely right. I mean, Spotify, you know, or the music industry in general has never been known as – the digital music industry has never been known as some great, you know, cash cow. Spotify does lose a lot of money. Their argument has always been that if we want to turn a profit right now, we could. You know, we're so invested in growth. We're so invested in spreading you know, our platform to as many users as possible, that we don't care about profit right now and we're focused solely on growth, which is an argument for longtime tech observers is not unique to Spotify by to any extent.
Mm-hmm.
Ultimately, you know, I think their bigger picture argument here is as we grow, we will gain more and more leverage within with labels that we're negotiating with, and that'll increase our margins and that'll make us a more attractive business and ultimately is a good sell to Wall Street. Now, obviously, that involves that includes the assumption that as they gain more and more users, they'll be able to negotiate royalties to the labels further down. Will that happen? I think there's some early evidence that they've been successful. You know, and the S-1 had a treasure trove of documents that showed that Spotify has been able to kind of increase margins slightly.
Huh.
But that's the core of their pitch, well, that they will have a better relationship with music labels and have more leverage as they grow.
The man who is leading this IPO is a former executive at Netflix. Two companies with sort of similar ideas here. I mean, are there comparisons that can be made between them?
Absolutely. I mean, these are both media businesses that have thrived on paid subscription models for content. You're right. The man Barry McCarthy, who's the CFO of Netflix, formerly the CFO of Netflix, and is now the CFO of Spotify. You know, there's a lot of similarities between these two businesses, and that's the argument certainly that Spotify investors want to make because Netflix is absolutely killing it on Wall Street. There are some differences, though. I mean, you know, Netflix basically the model is you pay. You know, Netflix pays the content creator once for the material, and then can stream it as many times as they want.
Yeah.
Spotify basically has to pay each music label an individual time every time a song gets played. So there are some differences in the subscription model. Certainly, Spotify wants to be compared to Netflix, and having the same CFO, which is taking both companies public, you know, certainly carries an implicit assumption that, you know, Spotify could perform just as well on Wall Street as Netflix has.
And just briefly, Netflix also invests a lot of money in now producing its own content. Do you see a day when Spotify decides it can make money that way?
Sure. I mean, Spotify, I think more generally has made motions to expand beyond just streaming other people's music. I mean, they've talked about other, you know, I think there's been some speculation about other types of content business, maybe even video. You know, they've done some things in podcasts.
Yeah. Ultimately,
you know, they that is something that certainly would be an expansion of Spotify's historical.
We got to leave it there, Teddy. You know, Teddy Schleifer, a senior editor at Recode. Thanks very much for your time. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.